ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 17, Description of the Varnashram System, Text 39. Grihārti
Grihārti
Sadrishim
Sadrishim
Bāryam
Bāryam
Udvahed
Udvahed
Ajugupsitam
Ajugupsitam
Yaviyasim
Yaviyasim
Tu
Vayasa
Yam
Sa
Varna
Anu
Ramat Grihārti Sadrishim Bāryam
Grihārti Sadrishim Bāryam
Udvahed Ajugupsitam
Udvahed Ajugupsitam
Yaviyasim Tu Vayasa
Yaviyasim Tu Vayasa
Yamsavarnam Anukramat
Yamsavarnam
Grihārti Sadrishim Bāryam
Grihārti Sadrishim Bāryam
Udvahed Ajugupsitam
Udvahed Ajugupsitam
Yaviyasim Tu Vayasa
Yaviyasim Tu Vayasa
Yamsavarnam Anukramat
Yamsavarnam Anukramat
Grihārti Sadrishim Bāryam
Grihārti Sadrishim Bāryam
Udvahed Ajugupsitam
Udvahed Ajugupsitam
Yaviyasim Tu Vayasa
Yaviyasim Tu Vayasa
Yamsavarnam Anukramat
Yamsavarnam Anukramat
Griha,
Griha,
household,
household,
Arati,
Arati,
one who desires,
Sadrishim,
possessing similar characteristics, Bāryam,
a wife.
Udvahed, one should marry
Ajugupsita
beyond reproach,
Yaviyasim,
younger.
Yanga.
To
indeed
Vayasa
by age
Yam
another wife
Savarnam the first wife who is of the same caste Anu
after
Kramat in succession. Translation. One who desires to establish family life should marry a wife of his own caste who is beyond reproach and younger in age. If one desires to accept many wives, he must marry them after the first marriage, and each wife should be of a successively lower caste. Or varna. The word caste is used, but the Sanskrit word is varna. Yes, so interesting subject matter. Purport. As stated in the Vedic literature, Tisro varna nupurvyena dve tataika yatakrama brahmana kshatriya visham baryasva shudra janmana. The purport of this verse is that one's first wife must always be sadrishim, or similar to oneself. In other words, an intellectual man should marry an intellectual wife. A heroic man should marry a heroic wife. A business-minded man should marry a woman who can encourage him in such activities. And a shudra should marry a less intelligent woman. The wife must be beyond reproach in terms of her background and character, and should always be younger than oneself, ideally 5 to 10 years younger. If one desires to marry a second wife, then, as stated in this verse by the word Varnanu Purviena, and in the verse spoken by Lord Krishna, and in the verse spoken by Lord Krishna by the word Anukramat, one must wait until the first marriage is established and then select a second wife from the next lower caste. If one marries a third time, the wife must be again from the next lower caste. For example, a Brahmin's first wife will be a Brahmani. His second wife will be from the Kshatriya community. His third wife from the Vaishya community, and fourth wife from the Shudra community. A Kshatriya may first marry a Kshatriya lady, and then Vaishya and Shudra ladies. A Vaishya can accept wives from two classes, and a Shudra will accept a wife only from the Shudra class. By this progression of marriages, there'll be relative peace in the family. These Vedic marriage injunctions, as mentioned in the previous verse, are especially for those who are not pure devotees of the Lord. Griharti sadrishim bharya udvaheda jugupsitam yaviyasim tuvayasa yamsavarnam anukramat. One who desires to establish family life should marry a wife of his own caste, who is beyond reproach and younger in age. If one desires to accept many wives, he must marry them after the first marriage, and each wife should be of a successively lower caste. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vrishtaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Chari Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastichyadishtari Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasati Gauravakta Brinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Vajkalpacharubhya Jagripa Sindhu Vyavaja So, of course, in one sense, a verse like this is not really very easy to give a class on. Not that any verse is sort of truly easy as such, but in a certain sense, this is, you could say, a somewhat esoteric subject matter in its own way. And first thing we have to bear in mind, it's very important in looking at a verse, at this verse, and some of the others that we've also looked at over the past so many days, the verses from this chapter, or at least many of the verses from this chapter. This is specifically in the context of Treta Yuga and the, first of all, the personal conditions in Treta Yuga, personal meaning of the people, how they were. And just to give some small idea of the degree to which there was difference in all respects, actually, physically, psychologically, and spiritually in many ways, just to give an idea of how different things were then compared to how things are now, just as now there is, according to Shastra, and we see it very clearly, a concept that the average life expectancy in this Kali Yuga is 100, or not even average, but it's like a maximum. In other words, if you live more than 100, that's quite extraordinary, which is a fact. So the average life expectancy in Treta Yuga was 10,000 years. So that's 100 times longer. In such a yuga, the average life expectancy was 100,000 years. But then things deteriorated into the Treta Yuga, and that the fact that it deteriorated by a factor of 10 in terms of life expectancy, we could say, is in one sense an indication of how things just deteriorated on the whole. I was reading, in one of the verses a few weeks ago in the earlier parts of the chapter, there was mention of how the principles of religion deteriorated by 25% from Satya Yuga to Treta Yuga. Therefore, Varnashram was introduced in Treta Yuga. Whereas in Satya Yuga, there was no Varnashram system at all. It didn't exist. And it didn't exist because there was no need for it to exist in order to order society, because the people were just so advanced. They didn't need these, you know, like very kind of strict and precise types of discriminatory, regulatory rules. They were different. They really were different. So there was 25% deterioration, and as it would happen, we discussed briefly during that class how there are four principles of religion: austerity, mercy, cleanliness, and truthfulness. In Kali Yuga, we're aware the only one remaining is truthfulness. And that was earlier in Kali Yuga. Nowadays, just by our own practical experience in so many, I'm sure we've all had many experiences, that one principle of truthfulness is really under severe attack. Very severe attack. So, just like Srila Prabhupada said, when talking about lawyers, Prabhupada made a linguistic joke. Lawyers, liars. Yeah. Just, you can say liars. Lawyers, liars. And, of course, the majority of people, at least in the Western world, the majority of people who become politicians are lawyers. So, Hare Krishna. So much for that. There are many things we could say about that, but this is, truthfulness is the only one still remaining. Mercy has gone. Austerity is long gone. Cleanliness, sure, is really gone also. So actually, I happened to just come across it somewhere in the meantime. The first one to go, between Satya Yuga and Treta Yuga, the first one to go was austerity. Came across that. It may have been in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on that verse. So anyway, my point here really is that Even though this verse is a Srimad Bhagavatam, it is spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead Himself. Lord Krishna Himself is speaking here. But, and this is also pointed out quite clearly by our acharyas, in some parts, even of Srimad Bhagavatam, not to speak of other scriptures, but even in Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the most absolute of all scriptures, of all literatures, but there are certainly parts which are specific, in some cases specific to certain times, places and circumstances, and are not just totally universal principles, then there are some verses which are spoken by non-devotees, and they express their understanding, which the point is made in the context of a statement by such a non-devotee, and how that actually it's not true. And like this. So it is not that every single verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, that just whatever it says, can just be taken on face value. And of course, one of the important points that comes out as a result of that is that one needs guidance while studying Srimad Bhagavatam. Otherwise, one almost inevitably, really, will make some mistakes and find some statement which is not an absolute statement, and but accepted as such, and then come across other statements which may be absolute statements which contradict it, and then before you know, confusion sets in. One classic example of this, and very well known to us, is Lord Krishna Himself preaching to Nanda Maharaj that you mustn't perform the Indra Puja, you must do the Govardhan Puja. So Lord Krishna argues on the basis of Karma Mimamsa. Karma Mimamsa is not true. There are elements of truth in it, of course. It's a sort of a Vedic type perspective on life, but it is certainly not completely true. It's certainly not the absolute truth or para dharma, the supreme dharma. At best, it's relative, and in many ways it's actually misleading, and particularly how Lord Krishna preaches it is deliberately misleading. He's actually trying to mislead Nanda Maharaj and his friends, which he succeeds in doing. And then he preaches that we should actually do Govardhan Puja, which of course is true. I mean, it is true that they should not do Indra Puja, but not for those reasons. And then he preaches that you should do Govardhan Puja, but he presents also some sort of, anyway, it's kind of marginal logic as to why you should actually do Govardhan Puja. Points like, if you really want to acknowledge via some offering of respect and offering of puja, if you really want to acknowledge your good fortune, how you've managed to achieve your different goals, they were farming people, so how you've managed to achieve your farming goals, you should offer some appreciation or puja to the people who really help you. People or even the things which actually help you. And who are those people? They are the Brahmins. They are the cows. And what things help you? Well, go the downhill. In that sense, it could be said, Govardhan Hill is a thing. It's just a hill. But because it's very fertile and so on like that, then the cows can go and graze on it, and then the cows become very nice and healthy and produce lots of milk, and then you sell the milk or trade the milk, and in this way you live an affluent life. So it's not quite as sort of, you know what, material as that, what Krishna says, but there definitely are elements of that sort of idea in what he says. So if you don't understand, if you don't have someone or ones to help you understand Srimad Bhagavatam, then if you were to read that particular passage there and you were really not educated in Krishna consciousness, then it would not be surprising if you became confused. And there are people, many people who are confused in precisely that way. I remember first time I went to India, 1976, and Indira Gandhi, I think, somebody was the Prime Minister or Prime Minister, and it was a so-called state of emergency. It was really just their way of just taking control of the country more and manipulating things and people more. But there were many billboards and advertisements around. Well, in those days there weren't so many billboards and advertisements generally. But where there were billboards and advertisements, they were all, or so many, were from the government, urging the people to work hard. And there are so many quotes from Bhagavad Gita to the effect, and even translated specifically as, work is worship. Quote Bhagavad Gita. Because even to this day, but more in those days, people were very much oriented in that type of way, in a Vedic or quasi-Vedic type of way. So if you said, oh, Bhagavad Gita, then so many people would immediately be ready to accept. So work is worship. It was everywhere. It was just everywhere. So they're trying to use a mistaken conception of the message of Bhagavad Gita to manipulate the people for material benefit. So anyway, that's all by way of introduction to this rather extraordinary verse and purport. In other words, we should not be sitting here thinking that about doing like this. You know, first thing in one sense, although it's the last thing mentioned in the purport, it would have been arguably better if it was the first thing, is that this is really for non-devotees. Next thing is, it's for non-devotees in Treta Yuga. And it's not just, you know, for us here in Radharadanath Temple that we should now actually start to think in these terms. So, yeah, in Treta Yuga it was like that. That, well, as we mentioned on a number of the days, that because spirituality was so extremely prominent in society, not as much so as in Satya Yuga, but still compared to Kali Yuga, spirituality was just so pervasive, powerfully pervasive, and just so much the very foundation of human society, individually and collectively. So, therefore, all the young boys who would go to the ashram of the guru, means basically all the Brahmins, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, all of them would be trained from the age 5 till approximately 25. Then, after that brahmachari period of study and training under the guru was finished, then it's the next step. As we read yesterday, some would go home. Someone would return to their home, their homes, and then enter into household life. But a very significant number, particularly the Brahmins, but also in some cases Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, but particularly here we're talking about the Brahmins, they would decide at the end of their training, or through the training it would become clearer that this person does not need to enter household life. They don't need to. That was really the question. The question was, who needs to and who doesn't? And those who don't need to, in order to just facilitate themselves and their material desires, those who are not so materially desirous, then in so many cases they would not marry. This is particularly the young men. In so many cases. And they would become either traveling preachers, or they go live in an ashram in the forest and just live a life of meditation and fire sacrifice and whatever, just full-time spiritual activity. Others would become big scholars, shastris, but the thing is they wouldn't marry. People wouldn't, young men particularly, would not marry unless they needed to marry. This was fairly clear. And the result was that there was a greater number of young women to be married than there was the number of young men. And as a result, some men, not all, but some, would accept more than one wife. This is how it worked. And of course, nowadays in Kali Yuga, well, there's polygamy. What to speak of our respected state president. But in certain cultures, the Muslim culture, there's polygamy. Even in Hindu culture in India to this day, to some degree, there's some limited polygamy. It's definitely there. So the practice is there in human society, left over from before. Even in ISKCON, we've had a few attempts at polygamy. A few attempts. Our temple president in Johannesburg, in Mulder's Drift, from maybe 83 till something, 87, 86, a couple of years, he had two wives who were living there in the ashram, and I think one had one child, the other had two. Unfortunately, Kali Yuga being difficult, it didn't work. And there are others. We had another previously, when we were building the temple, one of the architects had two wives. That also didn't work out. And for that matter, it is said in Shastra that if in Kali Yuga a man is able to maintain one wife nicely meaning so she is really satisfied, happy, satisfied, taken care of and satisfied, such a man will be considered daksha, expert. Yeah. So, anyway, it's not easy. Our experience from observing, at least, is that it's not easy in the Kali Yuga. But in Treta Yuga, it was not unusual. It was not unusual at all. In fact, it was quite a standard practice. And if someone found out that their lady friend was the second or third or even fourth wife of a certain gentleman, there would not be some sort of reaction like, wow, what on earth is happening? Are you all right? Or, you know, some sort of reaction of that sort at all. It would be accepted. Just in a certain sense, just as to have more than one friend is not extraordinary. In fact, it's normal. People who only have one friend, that's extraordinary. So, and if you hear that someone has, you know, a whole circle of friends, that's normal. So, in Treta Yuga, that a man may have a certain number of wives, more than one, it was quite normal. And the experience of the wives, it was not sort of, you know, belittling to them or minimizing their value as human beings or anything like that at all. It was normal. It was not extraordinary. And for them it was normal. And they would have relationships with each other which were normal. That means the co-wives. And life was going on. Nowadays, of course, we don't really have so much polygamy. But at least in Western culture, we have, it's sort of the same thing in a sort of a sense, but anyway, we have divorce and multiple partners. And, you know, of course, in order to be divorced, you have to be married first. But we have just the practice of changing partners, whether married or not. And in one sense, it ends up, the principle is, Anyway, it's a reality. This is Kali Yuga. That people, it's so difficult, it's a challenge to coexist, cohabit one small space with one other person for an extended period of time is a challenge. Is a real challenge to many, many people. Be they married or in a male-female relationship, be they friends, be they employees, or whatever it may be. Kali Yuga, the atmosphere is so surcharged with sense gratification and individual, like exaggerated individualism and considerations like that, and people are so full of these types of moods that it's very hard to stick. It's very hard to stick either with one activity or one person or even one friend. This is part of Kali Yuga. It's all part of Kali Yuga. And Srila Prabhupada made the point that there's talk of United Nations. He was living in New York and he would pass by the United Nations building on Manhattan. He was living on Manhattan. He would pass by there from time to time. And he said sometimes he would notice rather than there becoming a lesser number of nations because the nations were becoming more united and more aware that, you know, what's the need for separatism? But Prabhupada commented that oftentimes he'd see there was a new flag, some new nation had been created. And Prabhupada, at least we heard, Srila Prabhupada said, that eventually Tamil Nadu in India will become a separate country. There are definitely plenty of people who want that. Eventually Punjab, Khalistan will become a separate country. And it is said that as Kali Yuga becomes advanced and governments become so corrupted and it becomes so hard for the people, so hard, eventually countries will break down more and more into little interest groups, and eventually each house will be a country. This is Kali Yuga. If you said to someone in Treta Yuga, that an idea like this of a man having a number of wives and there being, you know, a systematic process for accepting other wives, then so many people, you know, your average American would say, you know, this is something really very strange or archaic and strange. But from the point of view of the person, the average person in Treta Yuga, Kali Yuga is strange, to say the least strange. Kali Yuga is just like crazy, actually. Total craziness compared to the conditions and the conditions of the people in Treta Yuga. So, there are systems when it comes to marriage. This is, at least in principle, this is the point here, that there are definitely systems, and it's not, the system is not simply that you look good to me, I look good to you, let's get together. That's not the system. That's not the system. You know, it's such an important part of the system in Kali Yuga, and it's such an important factor in why so many marriages fail and so many of these partnerships break up. In so many cases, it's on the basis of somebody else looks better to me, I look good to them. Yes, so well, welcome to Kali Yuga. But there are systems, and here some of the simple parts of the systems are mentioned. That the wife should be younger. Why? Well, among other things, because of male conditioning, it tends to work better if the male is able to have the senior position. Even though it's a very close relationship, but still, that the male can be the head of the family. Generally speaking, this is better. So that's an interesting point. And then there would be astrological readings done to see the compatibility, because someone may look good to someone and that other someone may look good to the first person, but in terms of how they're going to be able to coexist for an extended period of time, and which will include, you know, a fair period of time when they stop looking so good and they actually start looking, you know, pretty tired and worn out and and just not so good in so many ways. So there has to be some real grounds of compatibility, otherwise it'll become impossible. And this is why in Western society there's so many relationships established simply on physical grounds, but after some time they break up, and they don't just break up, but in many cases they end up hating each other. In some cases they actually kill each other, and it's because of a lack of compatibility. They're just different types of personalities with different views on life, different needs and different desires. So like this, in Vedic society there was a system, and this is part of it. First wife should be like this. And if somehow the person feels inclined, or even if there's a need to accept more than one wife, then there would be a system for accepting the second wife. And it was, as we know from Mahabharat, that particularly for Kshatriyas, if they were approached by suitably qualified woman, if they were approached by a woman that, "I want to become your wife," they were not allowed to refuse. They're actually not allowed to refuse. And this is what happened to Bhima, isn't it? He got married to Hidimbi. Okay. Because he couldn't refuse. Because he was a Kshatriya. And she asked. So like this. We're talking about a different social environment and different consciousness. And people could do things like this, and it could work very nicely. And all the parties involved could be very happy. Yeah. And even there are things like, for example, in Treta Yuga and Dwapara Yuga, if somehow or other man and woman are married, but because of the physical, biological condition of the male, they were not able to conceive children, then the brother of the husband could conceive a child in the wife of the wife, and it would be normal. It would be normal. It would not be like, you know, some sort of scandalous situation. So we're talking about really a different social and cultural environment in so many ways. And of course also these conditions are not really there for devotees, certainly not devotees today. Yes. Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions?
Yes. When it's described that there's a 25% deterioration, like in terms of one of those principles of religion, it's not like it completely disappears in the next stage, because we see apparently some austerity in Treta Yuga.
That's true.
Yuga. So then what does it mean then? Is it that so drastically reduced that it shows like this?
It's really prominent. It's by far the most prominent. You know, there is some mercy today.
Mm-hmm.
There is some cleanliness. It's not like everything is a total pigsty, but that particular quality becomes very severely undermined, and that so you find a lot less people have it. And of course austerity, like we've mentioned, so many of the young men, Brahmins particularly, they would not marry. That's austerity. But in Satya Yuga, everyone was basically Paramahansa. So, you know, so everyone being Paramahansa means, it includes, they're really beyond the attraction of between the sexes. They're really beyond it. So, you know, but still, there was reproduction was going on, but not based so much just on like blatantly sexual attraction, but in Treta Yuga there was much more of that, yeah, much more relatively speaking.
And it gives the sense that our appreciation of what's austere now, you may think, oh, that's such a high level of austerity, it's actually nothing compared to what may have been in Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga.
Right. Yeah, right. Like they would go off for hundreds of years and, you know, take a vow not to eat more than, you know, just a little, really little, for 100 years.
Our idea of fasting halfway on Ekadashi is like so austere.
Well, yeah, I was just reading Prema Vivarta yesterday, last night. Lord Chaitanya is telling the devotees, on Ekadashi you must fast completely, according to Jagadananda Pandit, and you must stay up all night and chant. Yeah. Fortunately for us, Prabhupada did not teach that, nor did he demonstrate it. But it's there. And that was in Kali Yuga, that was just 500 years ago. Yeah, but our standard of austerity, it's extremely minor. And actually, you know, Prabhupada said, and back in the good old days, when, you know, lots of devotees in the temples and book distribution was really the program, Srila Prabhupada said that real austerity is to distribute books on the streets. And Prabhupada said, if you distribute one day of book distribution on the street is equal to 10,000 years of austerity in Treta Yuga. You know, going to the mountains and just sitting down. Yeah. That's the good news. Where's Madhu Mangal?
Port Elizabeth.
Sorry?
Port Elizabeth.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's quite clear. Quite a presence is lost.
Yes, very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.